Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of May 10th. This week we feature an interview with Stanley Hauerwas, who has just published a memoir entitled Hannah's Child. Professor Hauerwas teaches at Duke Divinity School in North Carolina, but for many years also taught at the University of Notre Dame. I spoke with Professor Hauerwas at King's College here in New York, and I began by asking him why he chose to use the biblical title, Hannah's Child.
Well, my mother and father married late, and they're working class people. My father was a bricklayer. My mother was from Hardscrabble, Mississippi. And they desperately wanted a son or a child. And they had trouble becoming pregnant. And my mother had heard the story of Hannah and Samuel. And so she prayed to God that if God would give her a son, she would give that son to God, which I say was perfectly appropriate, but did she have to tell me when I was six? I remember her doing that. I became a theologian because I couldn't get saved. That was an evangelical Methodist church where you were baptized and joined the church on Sunday morning, but you had to be saved on Sunday night. And I wanted to be saved, but I didn't think you should fake it. So about the time I was somewhere around 15, I'd started to date, so I was sinning. And I thought I needed to be saved, but it just didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So some of the youth in the church had started dedicating their lives to the Lord. And I thought, well, if God isn't going to save me, maybe if I dedicated my life to the Lord, that would put God under some bind. So I did. After singing I Surrender All for the 23rd time, I finally went up and dedicated my life to the Lord. And I'm sure that I didn't remember it at the time, but I'm sure that story was working on.
Well, you know, I thought I'd just read it. There's a few sentences in your book that I found just kind of made me stop and think, and I thought, well, maybe I can just read them and you can explain them or meditate on them for our listeners. One is from the beginning where you say, God is just not there for me. Prayer is never easy for me. Now, I found that surprising.
Well, I know people for who God is just there, and it's just never been the case for me. And prayer doesn't come easy. I talk in the book about when my wife told me I should pray before class, I decided I would, but I would have to take time to write them. And that's been a very good exercise for me. But I think that it's not that God isn't there for me is one of the conditions of being a theologian. That I never talk about experience. I don't think you should. And it makes me understand that we learn what it means to worship God from other people who have learned to worship God. So, one of the lines I have in the book that most people, I'm sure, don't need to become a theologian to be a Christian, but I probably did. And one of the conditions may well be is that God didn't think it necessary to have, that I had some immediate relationship with God.
And you say experience is not important or integral to your work as a theologian. Maybe you can just explain that to our listeners.
Well, I mean, that if you notice, I rarely appeal to any kind of high moment that most people associate with experience of God. I think that those may be interesting for some people, but I don't think you ought to trust them. I just as Augustine learned throughout his life not to trust himself, but rather to trust God. I don't think we ought to trust our experiences.
Another line that I wanted to read had to do with some of your experiences working with communities mentally disabled. And this one line is, learning to live with the mentally disabled might be paradigmatic for learning what it might mean to face God. Maybe you can explain that.
Well, if you have been around the mentally handicapped, one of the first things, at least in the beginning, is you discover that you're frightened of them because they don't pick up the clues that we habituate one another to have. And, for example, they oftentimes get very close to your face and you draw back. I think if the mentally handicapped frighten us, think about God. So it's a way of suggesting how quickly we want to domesticate what frightens us, and God should frighten us is one of the things I was thinking about. And then we should learn how God loves us as part of being frightened.
I think this next line is kind of central to your work as a theologian, where you say at one point, Christians have no home. Maybe you can talk about that.
It took me a long time. I'm a Texan, and of course, I've lived outside Texas most of my life, though Texas, if I think about it, is still home. But what it means, Hugh of St. Victor says, he who is at home in one country is still a child. He who is at home in two countries is growing up. He who is home nowhere is on their way to perfection. So there is a sense that what it means to be a Christian is you can always be on the move, and you discover by being on the move other Christians who make your life possible. So at once we're able to be at home anywhere, as because our true home is with God.
This next question deals with experience and some personal sadness that you've had in your life that you write about in the book, including the breakup of your first marriage due to mental illness your first wife suffered with. Yet in your book you say you resist the idea of trying to draw from this experience and to kind of that it's affected your theology in any way. Why then were you drawn to write about it?
I guess because I was trying to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And there is a sense that I was also trying to overcome the loneliness for myself and for others who will read it. Because when you are in the world of the mentally ill, it does create an isolation that you're not sure can be shared with other people. So I needed to share it in that way in order to, I don't mean it had no effect on how I think, but I don't do theology about that troubled relation in and of itself. What I don't know how it may or may not have shaped the way I think, as a matter of fact. But I just needed to tell it if I was to tell the truth about my life. I think also it was a way to say how the church was absolutely necessary for sustaining my son and myself through that time.
I'm not a theologian, but I work with a lot of theologians, so I asked them to give me some ideas for questions. The first one comes from my editor, Drew Christensen. And he mentions, you know, as you write your book, you've shared in many Christian communities during your life for worship, theology, prophetic witness. Now, at this point in your career, how do you see those various communities contributing to your thought and your Christian identity?
I think in the book, when I talk about leaving Notre Dame and South Bend and how important Broadway Christian Parish was for me, and how for many years I'd gone to Sacred Heart at Notre Dame, that I'm sure that whatever it means for me to be a Christian, I need both Sacred Heart, I need Broadway Christian Parish, I need the Church of the Holy Family, where I currently go, which is an Anglican church. I don't know what it means for me to be so ecclesially promiscuous, but I know I need all those churches, and I believe that God is there in each of them, and without it, I couldn't be a Christian. So I don't mean to underwrite church shopping in any way. Each of those communities have claimed me. And I'm kind of a living ecumenical movement. I suppose there's a sense I would like to be at home, but I'll never be. It's largely contingent reasons that you're at one place rather than another, though it's absolutely crucial for what it means for me to be. I try to do theology in a way that can serve what I think of as the coming great church and church in unity.
And just for our listeners who may not be familiar, when you were at Notre Dame, you certainly did engage the work of many Catholic thinkers.
David Burrell, Jim Burchell, you know, there were a host of Catholic theologians, Herbert McCabe in England, Fergus Carr. I mean, they're friends and conversation partners that I couldn't be who I am without them.
Now, the next question I have comes from Roger Haight, who doesn't work in the magazine but lives there with us. One question he had is, if you look at the membership of mainline Christian churches, but also Anglo-Catholic churches as well, among Anglo-Catholics, the membership is declining. What do you see as the causes for that decline, and how might it be addressed by these churches?
Protestantism generally is in trouble. Protestantism is a protest movement within the Church Catholic for reform. When Protestantism becomes an end in itself, it becomes unintelligible to itself. So those of us who Anglo-Catholic liturgy is so important for, we must always pray for deeper unity of the church. And when we don't, you know, God may be killing us for not wanting that unity. I don't know. I'm sure there are immense sociological and reasons for the decline. I think when Christians try to say, oh, we believe what anyone believes, only we do these funny things in worship too, then no one thinks there's any reason that they ought to go to worship. Mm-hmm. And that kind of Protestant apologetic has been very prevalent, and it's killed us. And hopefully God will find ways to revive us.
Another question that Roger had was looking at, studies also show that often the behavior of Christians, the ethical behavior of Christians, is often not much different from non-believers. Do you think that ethics is in any way a measure of a faith's authenticity?
Yes. Christians today, they're desperate to show that they represent the best humanisms around. And I think that is a strategy that's deeply unfaithful. Let's start with Christians recovering why they have a problem with war. I think that then that kind of ethics, I don't want to make a big distinction between ethics and theology. I think once you try to help Christians understand why they have a problem with war, then as a matter of fact, you're going to see a very different kind of human being that will make people wonder whether they would want to be a Christian. Mm-hmm. And that would be a very good thing. That'd be a very good thing.
Now we can return to some of the subjects you bring up in your book. And we're talking here at King's College. We're not far. We're in 33rd Street, Manhattan, not far from Ground Zero. The last part of your book deals with September 11th, the events of that day. And it's striking to me, at least, how this it wound up ending a lot of friendships, or at least long-term relationships you had with various, some Catholics, because of kind of the stand you took on that day. Maybe you could talk more about that.
Well, I regard one of the great tragedies after September the 11th was President Bush's, I think, pastoral response to the American people to assure us that we were still okay. And that pastoral response was, we are at war. And that seemed comforting because we knew what to do. We go out and kill somebody. Where, as Christian people, that wasn't war, it was murder. And we should have said, no, don't use that kind of description. So that would be exactly the kind of difference that I think we Christians need to start being able to recover. That we can help as Christian people, help other people understand why we describe the world differently.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was just to give an example of that time. I mean, you were a pacifist, and you were on the board of First Things, neoconservative journal, and their editorial after September 11th basically said that pacifists should not be part of this discussion. And that ended with your resignation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, these were my friends. I have high regard for them. I've admired the stance they've taken on abortion and other issues. Mm-hmm. But I simply had such deep disagreements on that. It didn't, if I didn't have a voice, I didn't see any reason why I should remain on the board. I thought it useful to resign, but I didn't lose personal contact with them.
Now maybe we could talk about, you know, somebody who is engaged in issues of pacifism. Much in the news today surrounds the president's efforts to kind of reduce nuclear armaments, an agreement reached with Russia. Have you been following these events? How would you assess them as a Christian, as a pacifist?
I have been following them. I regard them as realpolitik developments that are positive. I think, obviously, the Soviet Union, or Russia, the former Soviet Union, and America have more nuclear weapons than they could ever use. So it's just useful for each of them to say, we can build this stuff down, but don't think you're going to eliminate them. Mm-hmm. That's optimistic mm-hmm. in terms of that.
Now in your book, you write a little bit about your work ethic. You've always been somebody, so you get your energy from your mother. You're always up early. You're always you have a great deal of industry. What, you know, as you say, you're in your 60s now. What are your next projects?
Actually, I'll be 70 this summer.
Okay, well, you're still in your 60s.
Well, I want to write a book on peace. Mm-hmm. People always assume that peace is the absence of war, and I want to try to show that peace is a deeper reality, both metaphysically and morally, than war. Mm-hmm. So I want to do that, and I will do what people ask me to do. That's what I've always done, mm-hmm. and I hope I'll continue to do that. I've had a wonderful life, and I've had a wonderful life because I've had wonderful friends. So I'll continue to want to engage in friendship.
Well, you mentioned some of these friendships in the book. You mentioned some of the people at Notre Dame who you knew over the years, but also many others. So if you want to know more, you can read this book, which is Hannah's Child, a Theologian's Memoir, and publication this spring, correct?
It's May.
May. Probably May. Well, Stanley Hauerwas, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. Reminder to go online, where we have a video feature this week by Drew Marquardt, Jesuit Scholastic, reporting from Walsh Jesuit High School in Ohio, where they have been doing a weekly outreach to homeless folks in Akron. That's in honor of our Jesuit education issue. Reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for American Magazine.